physical activity and enhancing their mental skills. The entertainment industry is constantly growing, and the Iranian brand says it needs to keep abreast of the latest trends. To this end, it has under its belt a dedicated R&D team that scouts for any new advancement in the field. There's a famous Iranian saying that goes, "A healthy mind is a result of a healthy body." And Kar Roshan is trying to materialize the exact same thing. The Iranian brand says at a time when technology is pervading every aspect of our lives, promoting entertainments that enhance our physical activity will build a healthier generation.
We are getting close to the end of our program, but before we go, let's check out some interesting news and trends in this industry and its related trades. If you like trade shows and exhibits, this bit of news is just for you. The capital city of Tehran will be holding a leather exhibition in January dedicated to accessories, shoes, clothing, furniture, and so much more. Nearly 150 companies will be participating in the three-day event. Businesses will be able to showcase their latest products and capabilities in the exhibition. The main purpose is for producers and other industry participants to expand their networks and find new markets. Also, the exhibit is a platform for knowledge transfer as businesses present their latest technical and industrial achievements in this field. Plus, such events offer opportunities for foreign investment, entrepreneurship, and sustainable employment. In Iran, much of the domestically produced leather is used to make shoes, and the industry is booming with massive productions. Presently, Iran can produce around 450 million pairs of shoes annually. That's according to the Iranian Association of Shoe Manufacturers. The sector is now setting a goal to increase yearly productions to 1 billion pairs of shoes in the next few years. The association estimates this would rake in around $6 billion in export revenues. Tehran plans to increase its shoe exports to neighboring regions as well as landlocked Central Asian countries. Market analysts attribute the growth in the domestic shoe industry to ban on shoe imports, which was implemented in 2018. They also argue that the fluctuation in the dollar exchange rate prompted more Iranians to turn to reasonably affordable, domestically produced shoes. And with that, we wrap up our program for today. Thanks for tuning in, stay safe, and I will see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
An all-out war on democracy is now underway in the United States. More than ever, the Republican Party is the electoral arm of white supremacy, as well as such toxicities as xenophobia, nativism, bigotry, patriarchy, and misogyny. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Norman Solomon Ryder. This article is published under the heading, An All-Out War on Democracy is Now Underway in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. The final big legislative achievement of 2021 was a bill authorizing $768 billion in military spending for the next fiscal year. President Biden signed it 2 days after the Christmas holiday, glorifying the Prince of Peace. A rosy view of the USA's future is only possible when ignoring history in real time. Dollar figures can look abstract on a screen, but they indicate the extent of the mania. Biden had asked for only $12 billion more than President Trump's bloated military budget of the previous year, but that wasn't enough for the bipartisan hawkery in the House and Senate, which provided a boost of $37 billion instead. Overall, the military spending accounts for about half of the federal government's total discretionary spending, while programs for helping instead of killing are on short rations at many local, state, and national government agencies. It's a non-stop trend of reinforcing the warfare state in sync with warped neoliberal priorities. While outsized profits keep benefiting the upper class and enriching the already obscenely rich, the cascading effects of extreme income inequality are drowning the hopes of the many. Corporate power constrains just about everything, whether the healthcare or education or housing or jobs or measures for responding to the climate emergency. What prevails is the political structure of the economy. Class war in the United States has established what amounts to oligarchy, a zero-sum economic system. As known as corporate capitalism, is constantly exercising its power to reward and deprive. The dominant forces of class warfare disproportionately afflicting people of color while also steadily harming many millions of whites, continue to undermine basic human rights, including equal justice and economic security. In the real world, financial power is political power. A system that runs on money is adept on running over people without it. The words, "I can't breathe," repeated nearly a dozen times by Eric Garner in a deadly police chokehold, resonated for countless people whose names we will never know. The intersections of racial injustice and predatory capitalism are especially virulent zones where many lives gradually or suddenly lose what is essential for life. Discussions of terms like racism and poverty, too, easily become facile, abstracted from human consequences, while unknown lives suffocate at the hands of routine injustice, systematic cruelties, the way things predictably are. An all-out war on democracy is now underway in the United States. More than ever, the Republican Party is the electoral arm of white supremacy, as well as such toxicities as xenophobia, nativism, bigotry, patriarchy, and misogyny. The party's rigid climate denial is nothing short of deranged. Its approach to the COVID pandemic has amounted to an embrace of death in the name of rancid individualism. With its Supreme Court justices in place, the grand old party has methodically slashed voting rights and abortion rights. Overall, on domestic matters, the partisan matchup is between neoliberalism and neo-fascism. While the abhorrent roles of the Democratic leadership are extensive, to put it mildly, the two parties now represent hugely different constituencies and agendas at home. Not so on matters of war and peace. Both parties continue to champion what Martin Luther King Jr. called the madness of militarism. When King described the profligate spending for a distant war as some demonic, destructive suction tube, he was condemning dynamics that endure with a vengeance. Today, the madness and the denial are no less entrenched. A militaristic core serves as a sacred touchstone for faith in America as the world's one and only indispensable nation. Gargantuan Pentagon budgets are taken for granted, as is the assumed prerogative to bomb other countries at will. Every budget has continued to include massive outlays for nuclear weapons, including gigantic expenditures for so-called modernization of the nuclear arsenal. A fact that this book cited when it was first published, that the United States had 10,000 nuclear warheads and Russia had a comparable number, is no longer true. Most estimates say those stockpiles are now about half as large. But the current situation is actually much more dangerous. In 2007, the doom's clock, maintained by the bulletin of the atomic scientists, pegged the world's proximity to annihilation at 5 minutes to apocalyptic midnight. As 22 began, the symbolic hands were at 100 seconds to midnight. Such is the momentum of the nuclear arms race, fueled by profit-driven military contractors. Lofty rhetoric about seeking peace is never a real break on the nationalistic thrust of militarism. With the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, the third decade of this century is shaping up to unfold new wrinkles in American hegemonic conceits. Along the way, Joe Biden has echoed a central precept of doublethink in George Orwell's most famous novel, 1984. War is peace. Speaking at the United Nations at the autumn of 2021 began, Biden proclaimed, "I stand here today for the first time in 20 years, with the United States not at war. We've turned the page." But the turn page was bound into a volume of killing with no foreseeable end. The United States remained at war, bombing in the West Asia region and elsewhere, with much information withheld from the public. An increase in U.S. belligerence toward both Russia and China escalated the risks of a military confrontation that could lead to nuclear war. A rosy view of the USA's future is only possible when ignoring history in real time. After 4 years of the poisonous Trump presidency, the Biden strain of corporate liberalism offers a mix of antidotes and ongoing toxins. The Republican Party, now neo-fascist, is in a strong position to gain control of the U.S. government by mid-decade. Preventing such a cataclysm seems beyond the grasp of the same Democratic Party elites that paved the way for Donald Trump to become president in the first place. Realism about the current situation, clarity about how we got there and where we are now is necessary to mitigate impending disasters and help create a better future. Vital truths must be told and acted upon.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of Parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party. Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability. Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, the opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism leveled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's why Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should have stepped down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. Add to it a looming cost of living crisis, inadequate public services, a pandemic to recover from, and ongoing difficulties caused by Brexit. It's now just a question of how long will Boris Johnson survive as the Prime Minister. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Ruzhi in Jiangsu province on Friday.
The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%,
including 62% in agricultural and food products, in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these. And they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to his security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if the escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were giving one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the US and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Mona Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent and in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of essential importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, that, as a result, of course, the Palestinian struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes, but at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian to support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. Corporate influence and corruption defines American politics. No wonder most think the country is headed in the wrong direction. We now present you an article written jointly by David Sirota and Andrew Perez. The piece is titled, If Americans Can't Have Basic Things Like Childcare, Their Democracy is a Sham. In 2014, Northwestern and Princeton University researchers published a report statistically documenting how lawmakers do not listen or care about what most voters want, and instead mostly care about serving their big donors. Coupled with additional research documenting the discrepancy between donor and voter preferences, they bluntly concluded that the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. 7 years later, America is witnessing a very public and explicit illustration of this situation in real time. And the country seems pretty ticked off about it. In the lead-up to Tuesday, 2nd of November, off-year elections, and in advance of the upcoming midterm elections next year. Recently, Joe Biden and Democratic lawmakers have been making headlines agreeing to whittle down their social spending reconciliation bill at the demand of corporate donors and their congressional puppets. The specific initiatives being cut or watered down in the Biden agenda bill share two traits. One, They would require the wealthy and powerful to sacrifice a bit of their wealth and power. And two, they're quite literally the most popular proposals among rank-and-file voters. New polling demonstrates the silencing effect that systemic corruption is having on voter preferences. 82% of registered voters support adding dental and vision benefits to Medicare. And according to survey data from Morning Consult, this is voters' top priority for Democrats' social spending bill. Conservative Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona have pushed to keep these benefits out of the bill, following an aggressive lobbying campaign by health insurers who enjoy massive profits from the privatized Medicare Advantage program. According to Morning Consult, another top priority for voters is allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, with 72% saying they support the idea. Senator Kyrsten Sinema and a few House Democrats backed the pharmaceutical industry managed to block the party's original drug pricing measure from being put into the reconciliation bill. On Tuesday, 2nd of November, Democrats announced they had reached a deal on a drug pricing plan, which Politico, the website Politico, described as far weaker than Democrats' promised legislation. One industry analyst said the deal seems designed to let legislators claim an achievement while granting Big Pharma protection. The opinion poll also found that 70% of voters support including paid family and medical leave for new parents in Democrats' spending bill. Senator Joe Manchin has demanded that this item be cut. After raiding against the Republicans' 2017 tax law for years, Democrats have largely refused to raise taxes on corporations and the wealthy, and their final bill may even end up being a net tax cut for the rich. This, even though President Biden's own pollsters found that raising taxes on the wealthy was the most popular of more than 30 economic proposals they tested during the 2020 presidential campaign. The flip side of all this also appears to be true. Democrats have protected initiatives to enrich powerful corporations, even though some of those measures aren't very popular. One example, subsidies for health insurance plans purchased on the Affordable Care Act marketplace that shower money on for-profit insurers. Morning Consult reports that extending new Affordable Care Act premium tax credits passed by Democrats in March is the lowest ranking of all the health measures included in the poll. The results of this latest middle finger to voter preferences? New polling data shows that almost three-quarters of Americans now think the country is headed in the wrong direction. Taken together, this is the democracy crisis thrumming underneath all the media noise. The day-to-day erosion of democracy by corporations that use a system of legalized bribery to buy public policy, which then erodes Americans' faith in their government. And yet this erosion does not get discussed in a media-directed democracy discourse that focuses almost exclusively on the 6th of January insurrection or Republican efforts to deny election results and limit voting. This is what my 2006 book called The Hostile Takeover, the conquest of democratic institutions by money interests to the point where the world's greatest democracy routinely rejects the common sense policies that the vast majority of voters want and that every other high-income country has already adopted. The hostile takeover is not just a rejection of the most popular policies, it is also the media discourse itself. The Washington Press is constantly portraying industry-sponsored opponents of majoritarian policies as moderates or centrists, and depicting supporters of those policies as fringe lunatics who refuse to be reasonable and compromise. Meanwhile, there is a pervasive omerta that silences most media discussion of the corporate influence and corruption that so obviously defines American politics. And there is scant mention that the moderate obstructionists are bankrolled by the industry's lobbying to kill the popular policies that the American people want. There is some encouraging proof that more and more Americans innately understand the kleptocratic nature of this government and want explicit accountability journalism to uncover it. Also, mildly encouraging is the impact of that reporting in the reconciliation bill battle. Democrats tried to get rid of all the drug pricing provisions, but were successfully shamed into adding at least a few of the pathetically weak provisions back in after independent media aggressively exposed the big pharma ties of key lawmakers. It is not a huge victory and not worthy of some effusive celebration of Democrats, because the provisions are watered down and a betrayal of the party's promise to do something a lot better. But it's a minimal proof of concept win. It may at least get the idea of Medicare negotiating drug prices into law for the first time. And as important, it shows that when there is a robust press willing to challenge power, the government can be forced, kicking and screaming, to respond, or at least pretend to respond. It's going to take a whole lot more of the kind of reporting and a whole lot more movement pressure to secure real wins and beat back the hostile takeover. The silver lining here is that at least the takeover is now explicit. The opinion polls show what people want compared to what being excised from the reconciliation bill makes this part of the democracy crisis impossible to deny. And ending that denial is a prerequisite for achieving something better.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
اونی که ما دیدیم از نزدیک کار او رو واقعاً مظهر تلاش بود. کار خستگی ناپذیر.
From what we observe of his work from up close, he was truly a manifestation of diligence and untiring work. After returning from trips to different countries, he would send me reports. When I would read those reports, I would be surprised at the massive amount of work that had been done over the course of a few days. I have kept a copy of some of those reports for myself and have written on them. I am keeping these so that they may be seen in the future, so that it will become clear how much work this man has done. I have copies of two or three such reports. Such was his untiring work.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
کار خستگی ناپذیر همراه با شجاعت، یعنی کاری که کار معمولی نیست، احتیاج به شجاعت داره، احتیاج به شهامت داره.
And he worked courageously. His work was not regular work. It required courage and bravery accompanied by rationality. It required both courage and rationality, and these both existed in this man at an admirable level. He was a man of acumen. He knew both the enemy and their resources. It was not such that Marta Soleimani did not know what the enemy's resources were, resources which the enemy could exploit and with which it could strike. So he was completely aware of the enemy's resources, but at the same time he would enter the field with complete courage and strength. He was not afraid of the enemy, and he would design strategies intelligently. I said this several times among the high-ranking officials of the country, both in the presence of Marta Soleimani himself and in his absence, that he did things wisely. On the one hand, he was courageous. Everyone is talking about his courageous acts and deeds. Furthermore, he would do things very intelligently. He was very meticulous. This is truthfulness. Of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they have made with Allah.
اما اخلاص، اخلاص او، صدق و اخلاص. اگر اخلاص نباشه، کار بی برکت میشه.
As for his sincerity, if there is no sincerity, one's work will be devoid of blessings. When one's work is blessed, this is a result of sincerity. How can we tell he had sincerity? It was obvious, since he would shun being seen. He was not after being seen in any way. He would avoid being seen. But things have turned out in such a way that the entire world is seeing him. The whole world is seeing him.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Erubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Strikes, protests, and parliamentary disunity have shown that opposition to President Emmanuel Macron's pandemic policies have reached unprecedented levels. Macron dominates his party, and his party dominates parliament. But France's controversial new vaccine smart pass was only just approved after more than 2 weeks of parliamentary chaos. It's one of the strictest vaccine passes in the world because it requires full vaccination. The vaccine hesitant can no longer provide proof of a negative COVID test to avoid almost total public isolation. There have been weeks of protests in favor of the rights of the non-vaccinated, and unions are planning enormous walkouts against a pandemic response which is accused of being imposed from above and without enough grassroots input.
In the end, it was Macron who decided alone, and that's why it's a big confuse for everyone. So, and that's why it makes a lot of confusion in the population, because just one guy who decides everything and a scientific committee who is more a justification for the decision that has been taken.
Vaccines in France are popular. 80% of the formerly vaccine skeptical nation is now fully vaccinated. That has many saying that seemingly scapegoating the unvaccinated is a way for Macron to solidify a precarious re-election bid.
Despite his immensely controversial tenure, Macron retains a hardcore base of support of around 20%. It's been long assumed that it will be enough to get him into the second round, where he will defeat a challenger from the far right, like in 2017.
The decision is are very influenced by the fact that the election are coming in April. So it's really difficult to go to the mandatory vaccination for Emmanuel Macron. Maybe he want to wait for his re-election to go from the vaccinal pass to the mandatory vaccination.
The vaccine pass will likely be contested in France's top court, but it is expected to go into effect this week. The Omicron variant is far less deadly than previous versions, giving hope that the pandemic is ending. But it appears that the nation's pandemic policies will be a major part of the presidential election this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Genocide, the deliberate destruction of an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. There have been many, with death tolls in the millions, and the threat of another is always around the corner. Organizations like the IHRC are fighting to prevent that by raising awareness. The theme of this year's event, how do states sanitize genocide?
Genocide is sanitized. It's not only the genocidal state which actively attempts to sanitize its crimes. Other states are also actively involved. Those which supply the weapons and other instruments of annihilation. Those which refuse to acknowledge or call out the genocide for fear of the obligations to prevent and punish the crimes taking place that they would be placed under. Those which fear offending trading partners.
There are more than 1,500 monuments across London commemorating everyone from controversial figures like Churchill to even fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes. But you would be hard-pressed to find a monument that commemorated the 1 million people killed in the Great Irish Famine, a genocide orchestrated by the British.
The British government conveniently omits England's role in bringing about genocides like the so-called potato famine from school books, like many other regimes that weave history in a way that justifies crimes against humanity.
Here's a real chance for the UK government and the Department for Education to truly celebrate, or rather I should say commemorate, the diverse groups of people that it can encourage our systems and our schools to remember because of who their predecessor governments have exterminated in previous centuries, whether we're talking about the indigenous people of Australia, Malays, Chinese, Indian subcontinent, Iranians, Iraqis.
Genocide Memorial Day is held on the anniversary of Israel's Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to 2009, which killed hundreds of Palestinians. Again in 2021, thousands of Palestinians were killed at the hands of the Israeli regime, which legitimizes its actions by evoking another genocide, the Holocaust. The vicious cycle continues, and therefore, so must the fight against dehumanization and ethnic cleansing. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates. with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled